two, three, four. This is Tuesday, May 7th, 1996. I am on my way to interview Sister Irma Corcoran, BVM of Chicago, Illinois, about the founding of Mundelein College in its early days. My name is Joan Steinbrecher, and this is my tape, number one, side A.
My request, and...
Well, would you like to start there with that
and
project?
I still haven't. No, I don't think so. This is your job. It's up to you.
Okay.
And I am trying, when I ever get at it, to finish putting the paper that I gave for the Renaissance meeting at the University of Indiana some time ago. It's a general Renaissance meeting, an Indiana thing particularly, but it was, the program was there. And I'm trying to put it in order for a periodical, because it really is unique. I have researched everything in that field, and this is the only spot, this particular, absolutely indisputable source of Milton's treatment of the temptation of Eve came from.
Oh, how marvelous.
And it's so much fun because it is in the Jesuit Cajetan's Commentarium in Gennison during the early 17th century, when every possible theologian was writing about Genesis.
Well, marvelous that you are pulling this all together.
Well, I had done a review of all of the Genesis material down to the writing of Paradise Lost, and this was one thing that nobody mentioned anywhere. I had no clue existed. It wasn't even in the Union Catalog, the Library of Congress. And I got a letter from Sister Mary Aurelius, who was the Mundelein librarian then, saying, would this be of any use to you? It was Cajetan's commentary in Gennison, which was in the form of all of the commentaries that were coming out. The theologians were getting out biblical commentaries in which they would quote the chapter under discussion from the Bible, and then they would give the opinions of all the theologians they wanted to call attention to, or all they could find. Mm-hmm. They were really remarkably ecumenical about it. But this was a commentary that they probably wouldn't have noticed because it was done for the Catholic University at Louvain, Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cheap. You see, Catholics were still underground in England.
Mm-hmm.
Any who amounted to anything. And people just hadn't noticed it, but it was cheap enough that the students in Catholic universities on the continent could afford it. It would be, I can't say, but it would be very cheap in comparison to the others because it was on cheap paper.
Mm-hmm.
And the ink was not particularly good. And it went through I don't know how many editions because it was used year after year after year in seminaries.
Men.
Yes. And Milton's father was a fallen away Catholic. He could possibly have had a copy, but Milton could have afforded it because it was the cheapest thing on record. And most of these commentaries were quite imposing to look at, and some of them were beautiful. And I had handled, I think 18 or 20 of them, all there were extant, I thought. When I got this letter from Sister Mary Aurelius saying that a seminary in Canada was closing, and it was selling its library, and would this book be of any interest to me? And she could get it for $7.50.
Oh my.
I wrote back special delivery. Get it quick. And she did, and here was this material. All of the things it quoted, I shouldn't be giving all this to you because it's probably not the kind of thing you want to talk.
Well, no, I want to hear about you, and so it is.
Well, if it's about me.
Well, your interest as a Milton scholar.
Goes.
Yes, yeah, being a Milton scholar.
And, yes, and if I do say so, it's shown my Milton book at the British Museum. The British Library, which when I was in England was in the British Museum, was practically worn out. And there isn't one derogatory comment on it. And it's marked, it's underlined, there are notes in the margins. And I had a letter from a PhD candidate at Cambridge University in England saying that he thought I'd be pleased to know that when he announced that he would like to pursue Milton for his dissertation, his director had handed my dissertation, my book to him, he called my Milton book, and said, if you're going to write on Milton, read this before you do anything else. And I felt very happy about it. Loyola didn't have a copy, but
how did your interest in Milton, how did that all come about?
Well, I was always interested in the Renaissance, partly because, well, I'll go back to this Chesterton thing first. He quotes a paragraph which he says is from St. Bernard, on the seven forms of procedures of temptation. Well, I went through all of the writings of St. Bernard in the Magna Patrilogia Latinae, and I think that's pretty complete at that time, and isn't there, so Chesterton was mistaken about that point. But the fact remains that the material is there. And in every one of those temptations that would not have been presented to or effective to people who were in the state of grace which Adam and Eve were allegedly created in, and of course they didn't know anything about modern science and evolution in those days, Milton mentioned and explained why it wasn't used on Eve. You know, it's just things that nobody else mentioned at all, things like that. And it's so funny when in all of these brilliant, chiefly Protestant commentaries, there was one very brilliant Catholic one, and a beautiful book too, and I have a microphone of that. And to have this thing from an ordinary run-of-the-mill Catholic seminary in Europe turn up just does something for me. And also, I've run into personally even some of these fine humanist scholars to whom their research, their scholarship is all the God they think they need. And they've been fine people. I've liked them. And if I bring out something that give some idea of what Catholic intellectualism was like in those days and the contribution that is there still to be explored. I feel I've done one of the things that's important for the knowledge of Milton and for the scholarship of women, but above all, a clue that maybe there is something in the thought about God more than they have thought about before. But I really became interested in the 16th and 17th centuries when my mother started me. One rainy, cold, dark day. My parents were a lot older than I was. My father was 47 when they were married, my mother 38. Almost 38. And she had taught for 14 years. But, you know, they were a long way from a child's psychology. And we didn't have any little people's books in our little library in the Sticks in Missouri, where I had my elementary school education, except once in a while somebody had given me a book about little bunnies or something when I was very small. And to get me out of the way and keep me quiet, my mother took out this big Shakespeare, complete works of Shakespeare, and opened it at Midsummer Night's Dream. She thought I would be interested in that. And I was. I was absolutely charmed by the fairies. I knew there weren't any fairies, you know, but I had imagination enough to enjoy it. And I thought Theseus was a bore. But
I just read that on Sunday.
Pardon?
I just read that play on Sunday.
Oh, you did?
On a cold, dreary Sunday afternoon.
Well, I read it first on a cold, dreary afternoon. And Hippolyta, and I think I was only, I was 8 going on 9, or 9 going on 10, I'm not sure which. And I know the age, because we used to go nearly every summer. We went back to Iowa, where we had come from originally, to our little town, which I'm going to visit another week. And I had a cousin, a boy cousin, a year and a half younger than I. And I played with him and his friends. And most of them were like other little boys of that age, and I was used to them because the men who worked for my father in Missouri all used to bring their little boys when they came to work on the farm. And little girls had to stay home and help Mama.
Yes.
So I never thought anything about playing with boys. It was like they were playmates.
Yes.
But one of them, one I liked best, was Don Moore. And it was said that he knew Shakespeare by heart when he was 10. And he was a year or almost a year older now. He was that summer, 10 that summer. And I liked Don. We just hit it off. And he was on a Romeo and Juliet kick at the time. He was said to, as I say, to have known Shakespeare by heart. And it was a cold, dark, rainy afternoon. My cousin and Wright Fraser, who was the dumbest boy in the group, had gone down to Mechanicsville to celebrate Wright's birthday with his cousins down there. He had a pony cart and they had driven down. See, this would be back. If I was 8, it would have been 1913, you see, long before your grandparents were extant. And so it was around that time.
Mm-hmm.
And Don decided it would be nice, it'd be fun if we, Don tried Romeo and Juliet. So we did, when I found out that that was what he was interested in time, at the time, I spent a whole day sitting on the floor in a guest room in my uncle's house, cramming. I shouldn't be boring you with all the Shakespearean history. But I can't resist interpolating this. After Midsummer Night's Dream, oh, I was just heartsick with Robin. Titania, the lovely fairy queen, fell in love with Bottom with a, an ass's head. That was the limit. And anyway, I absorbed Romeo and Juliet. I couldn't remember all the words, of course. But we decided to stage it at the fireplace in the Moore's living room. They had a long, wide living room. His mother must have been upstairs with a migraine. It was understandable that she had them. And her husband was the editor of one of the two-town newspapers. And so we had the house to ourselves. And he explained about Elizabethan theaters and everything, and the fireplace. They had a big fireplace, but it was cleaned nicely, swept all out for the summer. And that would do for the inner stage. Well, to proceed with the play, when we came to the point where I awakened from my drugged sleep and found Romeo dead beside me, I wept with what I felt was the dignity that such poetry deserved. And Don rose from the dead and scolded me. I should be tearing my hair and screaming and falling in a faint.
Oh my goodness.
And I was so angry at the insult to my histrionic ability that I stormed out of the house. I can still hear that screen door banging. I don't care, Don Moore. I wouldn't cry if you were dead. And then we went back to Missouri, and for weeks I grabbed, the paper came on Thursdays, the paper of the hometown. And I'd watch for that and be the first to get it. I thought it might be bordered in black. It might have Don's obituary in it. And if it did, I'd feel it was my fault. And they had moved away when I got back to Animal, so we left the next day or so.
So your interest.
Don became managing editor of Cosmopolitan magazine when he was 23. He graduated from Princeton at, oh, I don't know, 17 or 18 or something like that. He went on, he wrote there. From time to time, I'd see his name on books and a variety of things. And then one day, the younger of my two men cousins, the other one had gone on, was on Wall Street at that time. A clipping, he had just retired, and there was a delightful picture of him and his wife. And they had retired to Florida, Baccaratan, I think. And it told some of the things he had done. He had written these books. He had taught at Princeton and at one of the other Ivy League places, I forget which, and had been a radio announcer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so anyway, that was Don, and I'm sorry I didn't write to him when my cousin sent it. And if I ever get to a library that has the telephone books of different places. I'm going to look just for fun, and if he's still alive, I'm going to write
right to him.
Because it was such fun, and we had lots of fun. And Ed Gorman, who was another one of our gang, his family moved to Cedar Rapids, his father was a doctor, and he writes novels and mystery stories. Well, anyway, mother had books whenever she went anywhere. She came into Chicago from time to time. She always got a book as a souvenir of the trip. And she got the books of people of her generation were reading, Victorian poets for the most part. And, of course, Shakespeare and occasional books of that period. And then I had a very fine English teacher in public high school. We moved back to Little Tommy in Iowa. And the principal taught the senior English, and she was very good. And I got slightly interested in Milton there, but I was more, I was interested in his cosmology when at Catholic University I went to Columbia from the novitiate, Sister Mary Justicius sent the five of us who had our degrees when we entered the novitiate. Away for masters, because she wanted them for Mundelein. Mundelein would open here, and then we didn't know there was going to be such a place.
Ah, okay, because that's, I'm interested in that, too.
She sent two to the Jesuit St. Louis University, which was the only Catholic university that was generally respected at that time. And while there were a lot of BBMs with master's degrees floating around the high school, she couldn't take them away from those schools.
Yes.
She already had assembled good many people.
So she was in charge of
The co-founder and the first president of Mundelein College.
Already then she knew she was going to establish the college.
She had spent, this was the thing she did scholastically. I've heard it over and over, she was a great builder, but she was no schoolwoman. She was a schoolwoman. Five of us in the novitiate had our degrees before we entered. Most of them were just kids who came right out of high school. They all stayed though. And she took the five of us who had degrees the day after, and we sat around the novitiate. Provincials were sending for the ones they wanted for this school and that school and the other school. And more we felt, they don't seem to want us. And the next day, Sister Mary Justicia came along, and she was the one who was in charge of the building of Mundelein. We didn't know there was going to be a Mundelein, and told us two were going to St. Louis. She didn't tell us anything about each other. She just gave the direction to those two, one by one, and two to Ann Arbor, Sister Mary Columba, who later was business manager, and Sister Mary John Michael, and me to Columbia.
So these were, you were the community that was then going to...
No, we were five young people who would be there, actually.
I see. All right. Not in administration, necessarily.
So, I was sent a presentation for months because Columbia wouldn't open until late in September. And my companion, we always went in twos in those days, had taught the lame duck Latin I took in freshman year, which was 8 hours, 4 hours a semester. I had had only 1 year in high school because that was all we could get in our own public high school. They said only the Irish wanted Latin, so they didn't offer it. But we got it in senior year because another one of my friends' father became head of the school board. They were good Methodists, but Curtis said he would be ashamed to apply to any college or university he wanted to go to without having had any Latin or Greek. So we got a year of Latin. We had had a magnificent teacher for French. We were all babbling French by that time. That is our little crowd. But in college then, in a survey, we had a very fine teacher. We didn't get very far. We just got as far as the romantic woman. She was so good, she spent too much time on people. But when I went to Columbia, the director of the master's program simply laughed at the idea of majoring in English for 1 year for a master's degree. Look at the scope of the English language and literature. You pick one period and you read everything extant that was published during that period. And then, and I can still see the sarcasm, you see, if you have time, read the criticism. But never be so pedantic as to talk about something you haven't read. Well, you know, that stayed with me.
Yes.
It was wonderful. Also, I was warned to stay away from his classes because he had said he hoped there wouldn't be any nuns in his class. Well, there was only one other sister, as far as I knew, on the campus besides my companion and me. She was in something else. And anyway, he was in the Romantic movement, and because Shakespeare was about the only one I knew anything about, I chose the late 16th and early 17th centuries. And the man I had for for Renaissance poetry was the editor-in-chief of the big 12-volume collection of Milton's works. So of course we got a lot about Milton, and we bought a book of the poetry of the period. Did that on our own, but we got a lot of Milton, and I got interested in him. And from my very early childhood, I never had catechism, never had Catholic school. And my mother got all her religion from the old Jansenistic Irish priest of her day. And she was born in 68, I think, 1868. And she didn't question anything about theology, which I did. And to be sure I would be very good, she said, God saw everything you did all the time. And I couldn't get this idea of God straight in my head. And my mother, you didn't question anything about theology in my mother's view. You memorized it. But my father was a convert, and he had the same miserable, inquiring kind of mind I had. So she told him, for heaven's sake, straighten this child out. And he convinced me there was a God anyway. He used the all cosmological arguments of St. Anselm. And I don't think he had ever heard of St. Anselm, but he had read everything. He learned to read at the age of 3, and he never stopped. And so when I got into Milton, I was interested, you know, in mm-hmm. his ideas of creation. Mm-hmm. And everybody was fundamentalist at that time. You have no idea the changes I have seen all through. And my father was an amateur anthropologist, archaeologist, paleontologist, you name it, anything in science. Mm-hmm. And the big event for the two of us was the arrival of the book catalogs in the spring and the fall. He sat at one side of the kitchen table and I sat at the other, and I could pick out a book that I wanted and he would pick out what he wanted. When I got up to being able to spend a dollar on a book, I leveled it up. We didn't have much money, much cash, and it was very judiciously mm-hmm. harbored. Yeah. One of the great things my father got, and it is still referred to seriously by anthropologists,